us, a busy mansion. So we go a little deeper into Hilchos Deos. It's Sunday morning. I think this is like the fifth Shia in Hilchos Deos. But we're going to get into now the Shita. So I have an interesting question for you. Okay, look at this picture, this Haredi and Chayal. Okay, you see this? And what word comes to mind? You have to pick a word. Quick, whatever comes to mind first.
Unity.
Yeah, let's go.
Same.
I
have no idea. What card?
You think unity. Who's sitting in the back? Andrew?
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you think?
Diversity.
Pardon?
Diversity.
Diversity. Yeah. Mikey?
Contrast.
I'll give you a minute. Yeah, Shlomo. What he said, okay.
Diversity.
Do you know, it takes more words to say what he said than just to repeat the word. But this is just a thought. Yeah, Carl? Not sure. Okay. Shlomo?
Diversity.
Nonchalant.
Pardon?
Nonchalant. Relax,
nonchalant.
Unity.
It's interesting to me. Nobody said compromise. Nobody said balance. Nobody said moderation. It's interesting. Right? And it's interesting that these two fellows may be standing next to each other. They may be brothers. They may be cousins. Or they may have absolutely nothing to do with each other. They just happen to be standing next to each other. Right? And the question is, how do you transform this into a meeting of extremes? And I'm not saying that those two are extremes, right? Because each of those individuals could be extreme or moderate in his own right. But now the Rambam gets into what the issue is, right? So we said in Halacha Gimel, okay? We said in Halacha Bet that there are extremes, and that in between these extremes, Ben Kol Deya V'Deya Rechokah Mimena, right? Ben B'Kitzeh Acher, Deot Beinoniot Zu Rechokah Mizu. There are middle grounds, right? And we talked about the fact that there are character traits that are inborn, they're part of who you are. And then there are character traits that you have to acquire, okay? You acquire them by habit, you acquire them genetically, right? You're born with them. And then in Halacha Gimel he says, Shtei ktzavot harechokot zu mizu shebechol deya v'deya einan derech tova. Okay? Being at the extreme, at either extreme, is not good. Now, by the way, you could debate this, okay? Rav Chaim Brisker believed that the Rambam was not only a master organizer, but that he was very, very particular about the words he chose. That he was a master of pshat. That he understood that words that were used in the Torah have deeper and very diverse meanings. As a way of understanding this, before the Rambam wrote the Yad HaChazaka, he wrote the Moreh Nevuchim. Has anybody here studied the Moreh Nevuchim at all? Anybody? The Guide to the Perplexed? No? The Guide to the Perplexed was basically written by the Rambam because of his sense of what a philosophical, theological turmoil the Jews were in as a result of the conflict between the Catholics and the Almohades. Okay, the Christians and the Muslims were at war, specifically in the area that he was in Spain, and the Jews were very often caught in the middle. And this created, just like every difficult time the Jewish people have been in, deep, deep theological challenges. So he wrote, based on some of the questions he was getting, a Moreh LeNivuchim. Now, to be Navoch is to be confused, perplexed, and therefore it's become known as the Guide to the Perplexed. The Guide to the Perplexed has three sections. And without going into details, the first section is basically a dictionary of terms. It's an amazing piece to study. He says, before we can talk theology, we first have to be able to communicate. We have to understand each other's terms, right? I can't talk to you about whether man is created in the image of God before we define what an image is, right? It says that Hashem created Adam b'tzelem Elokim. What does that mean? What's a tzelem, right? What does the word Hashem mean? What does the word Elokim mean? What is rachamim? What is chesed, right? What is din? All these terminologies. I never counted them, but there are probably a couple hundred terms in there. And he's got a paragraph on each of them. It's not an easy thing to study. Each paragraph bears a lot of thought. It's an amazing thing to do by Chavruta. Some of it blows your mind. Some of it I'm still processing years and years after I've studied it a few times. But the Rambam has an article there on Tov. And he comes to the conclusion as to what the Tov is, very simply. What is Tov? So we were talking in Kashrut when we had our discussion on Kashrut last week. And we said that one of the ways to come to understand something, if you can't understand it directly, is to understand it indirectly. Right? So how do you understand something indirectly? If you want to know what Tuma is, you can try to figure out what it is, or you can try to see if the Torah at least tells you what it's not. So we said the opposite of Tuma is Tahara, is Kedusha, purity, holiness, and that helps us understand what Tuma is. So what is Tov not? Or what is not Tov? Pardon? Well, now that's interesting. See, that's what I would have thought. And that's what the rabbis will say. But that's not what the Torah says. Because that still leaves you defining what Ra is. The Torah actually takes the time. You know, whenever you see something as it appears the first time in the Torah, that's a paradigm for what it means. That's the essence of what it means. I'll give you an example. It says in the Gemara, Haro'et tet bechalom. Whoever sees somehow the letter tet in a dream, he should expect it's a pelet tov. He should expect tov, because tov starts with the letter tet, right? So the Vilna Gaon asks a really good question. He says, wait a second. There's a lot of things that start with the letter tet. Tum'ah, impurity, starts with the letter tet. Treifa starts with the letter tet. So why should I expect good? Maybe I should expect treif or tummy. So Vilna Gaon says, because the first time you find the letter tet in the Torah is with the word tov. And therefore the paradigm of that letter, the essence of it is tov, is good. We can mess it up, but it's tov. So where's the first time in the Torah that I find the word, right? Tov? In creation. And when do I see that something is not tov? It must be Bali Kriya here. Come on, you're Bali Kriya here. Where do I see the Torah something's not good?
Just
what's
man,
not good?
It doesn't say if man's good.
No, it doesn't say man's not good.
It doesn't say man.
What? That's right. Lo tov v'yot adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. The essence of what is not good is alone. Now think about this. All the character traits that you find here, the root of them is that man is looking at himself and therefore thinks he stands alone. Take, for example, arrogance. The root of arrogance is that my life becomes all about me. I am the focus. Right? That's the root of arrogance. The root of anger, right? In fact, it's interesting. I mentioned to you last week, but we didn't get into it. The Gemara says that a person who is controlled by anger, kilu oved avodah zarah, it's like he's idolatrous. That's pretty extreme. I mean, you can imagine that, you know, we have a somewhat laid-back framework here, but you know, if somebody was publicly practicing idolatrous pagan worship in the dorm, you can imagine we might think that problematic. That might be worse than, you know, an iPod on Shabbos, right? So, what does idolatry have to do with anger? By the way, what would you have to do to figure out what idolatry has to do with anger? As a system. What would you have to do?
Be an idolatry.
Pardon?
Be an idolatry.
No, you don't have to be an idolatry to figure out why what idolatry has to do with anger. What do you have to do?
We'll get people who are idolatry.
No, before you get that. That may be how you do it. If I tell you, you know, you're a shmuchler, and you don't know what a shmuchler is, what do you obviously have to do?
Look it up.
You have to figure out, you have to define what a shmuchler is. So if I tell you that anger is somehow related to idolatry, you have to figure out what anger is, and you have to figure out what idolatry is. So what is idolatry? What's avodah zarah? Let me ask you a question. If you were an airline captain, and you spent most of your time on the road, right? And your wife was somehow, God forbid, nervous that you were doing things you shouldn't be doing, right? So you might understand that it might be tempting for an airline pilot on the road all the time with stewardesses to be tempted. But do you believe that if you're going to India, that you're going to be tempted to idolatry? Like, are you worried that you're going to walk by a store and get really excited about a pagan idol or a Buddha and just do kind of like, you know, right? Like, that just doesn't speak to us. What is idolatry? So the Rambam, and this is, by the way, a theme, right? Anyone want to take a stab at what you think idolatry is?
Well, materialism.
Well, why would idolatry be materialism?
Because it's a selfish thing.
I'm not sure it's selfish. I think it's more than selfish, although selfishness could be a form of idolatry.
It's the inability to separate God and everything else. It goes beyond God, beyond everything else.
The inability to separate God from everything else. Well, wait a second. Then I'm an idolater, because I don't know how you could separate God from everything.
It's always the fact that God is beyond everything else, as well as everything else. Maybe that's only easy to see that something is God.
Well, by definition, if you're in the midst of an intense form of idolatry, so you're removing God from the equation. So let me make this simple for you. The Rambam in Hilchos Avodah Zarah does a fascinating thing. Okay? When he starts the laws of idolatry, Hilchos Avodah Zarah, so he does a very strange thing. You would expect to find at the beginning of Hilchos Avodah Zarah, the laws of idolatry, you know, all sorts of technical details. Are you allowed to do business with an idolater? What's the definition of idolatry? What happens if you're gaining pleasure from money that comes from idolatry? All sorts of questions like that, right? Are you allowed to save an idolater on Shabbos? All sorts of stuff like that. But the Rambam all of a sudden goes into a history lesson. So it's basically once upon a time, in the times of Adam and Eve, you know, there were people who spoke with God and communicated with God. And then they had a hard time relating to reminding themselves to such an abstract. So they looked for ways to find God in the world. So they picked the greatest things in the world, the sun, the moon, the stars, and they began to face them when they prayed so that they could recall the greatness, the majesty of God. And then gradually, they started praying to these things and forgetting that the reason that they were praying to them was in order as a vehicle to God. And they sunk into a morass of idolatry. And it takes the Rambam like 3-4 halachot to give you this historical synopsis. And you look at this, you're not sure like why the Rambam is doing this. He doesn't go into a historical background to Shabbos. He doesn't go into a historical background to davening. So one way of understanding it is that the Rambam is trying to define what idolatry is. Idolatry is very simple. Idolatry is when you take a means and you make of it an ends. When they were looking at the sun and the moon and the stars and they understood that they were vehicles to developing a relationship with Hashem, it wasn't idolatry. But when they forgot that and they started to think that the sun and the moon and the stars were the goal, then that became idolatry. Now, if that's true, there are lots of forms of idolatry. Money is an incredible gift, and you can do great things with money. But if money becomes the goal, it's a form of idolatry. Power can be idolatry. You can be your own idol. Because you and the development of you, sometimes you need to focus on yourself. In fact, you can make a case for saying that this year is about focusing on yourself. But that's not the goal. That's just a vehicle so that you can give to something bigger than yourself. But if you yourself are the goal, that's a form of idolatry. Torah can be a form of idolatry. Torah is not the goal. Torah is a vehicle. It's a vehicle to bring Hashem into the world, to make the world a better place. But if I make Torah the goal, if I'm sitting in yeshiva for 20 years, and the whole goal is that I want to become a big Talmud Chacham, just because I want to know lots of Torah, that's a form of idolatry, when you really stop to think about it. Okay? So, if that's true, then the reason that the Gemara says that anger, somebody who's controlled by anger, it's as though he worships idols, is because the root of anger is that I am my own idol.
So, if someone tries to work in a relationship with someone else, there's idolatry?
Well, every time...
become closer to Shlomo,
every time you're involved in anything in life, one of the valuable questions, can you hit the door, Rafi? One of the valuable questions to ask is why? Like, why do you want to work in a relationship with someone? Let's say you're dating a girl, okay? And you want to develop a healthy relationship with her because, you know, all sorts of things you can add to it. You got to ask yourself, why is it valuable to have a relationship with this girl? If the only value to have a relationship with this girl is to make me feel good, then I'm the goal. Then yeah, that's related to idolatry. It might not be halachically idolatrous, but there's something off with that. But if the goal is that I want to develop a healthy relationship with someone because by doing that I can contribute to the world, it's not just about me, then there's something very healthy about that.
Then the world's your idol.
Pardon? Well, no, because the question is, why do you want to make the world better? The only thing or non-thing in this world that isn't idolatry is Hashem, on a certain level. Right? If you meet people in this world, unfortunately, who are very manipulative. And what does it mean to be manipulative in relationship? It means it's all about you. You're not having a relationship for the sake of the relationship. You're not having a relationship because that relationship allows you to do good or to bring good into the world. You're having a relationship because it's good for you. You are your own worship. You're the focus of all your activity. And that becomes a form of idolatry, right? So if that's true, right, then the problem with the extremes, maybe, is that those extremes, to some degree, lose sight of the goal. Maybe. But the Rambam nonetheless says that, so when the Rambam says, Einah derech tova, the extremes are not good, you could make a case for saying that the Rambam is relating this to what tov really is. Right? The definition of something that's not good is that it's alone. So that would mean that the definition of something that is good is that it's not alone. The essence of good, the root of goodness, is that I'm never alone. Think about this for a minute. Okay? If you really have Hashem in your life, now you could make up God to solve this problem, but if you have Hashem in your life, you're never alone. Right? So the root of goodness is when you realize that you're not alone. What makes interrelated activities with other human beings good? Because you realize you're not alone. You don't function on your own. It's not just about you. It's about something bigger than you. And when it's just about you, when a character trait is causing you to be alone, then there's something off with that. Okay? Give an example of a character trait that you think an extreme, right, would be good. Like, for example, I don't know, not spending money. Right? Like you make a case for saying, you know, maybe your parents aren't doing too well, things are tough, whatever, you want to value money, so you don't want to spend money. Right? You don't want to spend money. So if the reason you're not spending money is because you care about others, then there might be something good in that. And then you'll be challenged to spend money when you realize that others might benefit from your spending money. And you won't end up in such an extreme. Right? You have 20 bucks in your pocket, and somebody's starving, and they want a bagel. Right? So you'll struggle with what to do, because on the one hand, you want to give to this person. On the other hand, your parents send you the money, and so that's a healthy balance. But if the reason you're struggling is because you just want to have the money, then that's not so simple. Right? And that may be at the root of how one stays from the extremes. Okay. Ve'ein ra'uy lo la'adam, la'lechet bahen, ve'lo lamdan la'atzmo. It's not good. It's not worthy. It's not healthy to allow yourself to get to extremes in any fashion. Okay? Ve'im matzat tiv'on notel la'achat mehen, o muchan la'achat mehen, o shekvar lamad achat mehen. And if you find that you're naturally drawn to an extreme, or you've learned an extreme, okay? Then you have to return yourself to the mutav, to the middle ground, to that place that allows you to be more central and not alone. Okay? And a person should go in the way of the good. And the Rambam is clearly saying the way of the good is that middle ground. So pick any character trait you want, right? Imagine that a person is sleeping 1 hour a night, because he really wants to make use of his time, okay? But because he's sleeping 1 hour a night, he can't keep his eyes open. And so all day, he's not getting much out of his day because he can't keep his eyes open. That's an extreme. On the other hand, imagine a person wakes up every day at 12 and goes to sleep at 10 or 2, and he's missing half his day. That's also an extreme. One of the interesting questions, really, is how you define an extreme. Like, what makes something an extreme and what makes something not an extreme? And you can dialogue on this till you're blue in the face. At the end of the day, we're going to see the Rambam suggests that deep inside a person, intuitively, we're given the gift to know more or less where the extremes are. The first stage is to at least know that that's an issue. Right? Every time you come across yourself experiencing a particular character trait, you got to ask yourself, am I at an extreme? Am I in the middle? Is there somewhere in between? Right? You know, I had a kid who went to camp. You know, some of my kids went to camps in different ways. And one of my children, when they were in camp, just had a really hard time the first couple of weeks. They were extremely homesick. I mean, crying and nebuch and whatever. And it was an extreme. And it was an indicator to me that this particular child was too connected to home. As much as I want my children to be connected to home, and I love the fact that they love being with us, it's not healthy, right? So if that's happening to a kid who's 10, it's actually healthy that a kid has that reaction, and it's healthy that they learn to get beyond that reaction. But what about if you have a kid who's 17 or 18 who's so homesick that they can't function, let's say, I don't know, in yeshiva for the year? So that's an extreme, right? We had a boy last year who was having a tremendous difficulty because he was really homesick. And it's much worse like when you're 18 because people expect you not to be homesick, which is silly because different people have different issues and they're perfectly normal. So this boy couldn't even talk about the fact that he was homesick because it was uncomfortable for him, like around the other boys. It took us a while to figure out, right? And eventually when I figured out like what he was having a tough time and why he was sad and why he was whatever, so we started talking about it. And I said, look, it's a bracha that you're homesick on one level because it means you value your parents, you value your relationship, whatever, but it's undermining your ability to have a healthy year, right? So we started realizing he was talking to his parents like 3 times a day. That's like an extreme if you're in Israel to be talking. If you're talking to your parents 3 times a day, long conversations, we could debate this. But let's assume for the moment that I'm right and that that's an extreme. So I said to him, stop talking to them 3 times a day. You know? Limit yourself. Go to the other extreme. Right? Now, how you know what that extreme is, we're going to get to. But that's a character. That's an issue of my character development. If I suddenly realize I'm an extreme, I've accomplished the first stage. I've realized I'm an extreme. Now, the question is, what you do about it? Haderech ha'ishara, and this is Allah Adalat. Haderech ha'ishara, hi midah beinonit shebechol deya v'deya. All right? The correct, the straight, where a person should be, is in the middle. Mikol ha'deyot sheyesh lo adam, and this is true for all character traits. You should be in balance. We should be moderate. Right? It's true with everything. It's true with politics. It's true with how we handle money. It's true with how we relate to our fellow human beings. You've got to be able to balance in life, right? So what's the middle ground? This is going to annoy you. You ready? This is going to annoy you. It's annoyed me. It took me a long time to figure this out. We're not going to get there today. But this should annoy you. He had de'a shehi rechoka mishtei aktavot richuk shaveh. Ve'ina krova lo lezu v'lo lezu. What's the middle ground? The middle ground is that place on a character trait line that is equidistant from both extremes. How does that help me? Like, I can imagine with some character traits, maybe you can figure it out. Like, let's say the extreme of stinginess is that you never spend any money. And the extreme of being too giving is that you could instantly give away all your money. So does that mean that the healthy middle ground is that you give away half your money? Like, that makes no sense. How would you define the middle ground in that particular character trait? Anybody? Just out of curiosity, do you agree that this makes sense? That we're seeking to find the middle ground in moderation? Okay? If you think about it, when you read a newspaper and you read of an event and it really bothers you, very often it will bother you because you feel that you've just read of an extreme. You know, I think it's beautiful to have a deep relationship with Shabbat. And I value people who walk down the street and it pains them. And in Medina Israel, maybe in Yerushalayim, not everybody appreciates the beauty of Shabbat. But if you're standing on a street corner, throwing eggs and frothing at the mouth because someone is on his way to the beach with his family having a good time but happens to be driving on Shabbat, in my mind, that's an extreme. Right? It's an extreme, which is probably why it bothers me. So how do you find the middle ground? How would you find the middle ground of being responsible with money, but not being too stingy with money? Anybody?
It's whatever works for you.
Pardon?
It's whatever works for you.
Whatever works for... What does that mean, whatever works for you? Who's talking?
John.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
If you're the type of person that likes to give, you don't want to be an extreme where you give away all your money, but you still give away a good amount of money and you still have it under control, then that's moderation. Or if you're the type of person who's kind of stingy, and you're not an extreme of, you know, never giving away money, but yet you still give away some of your money whenever you can, then it's a moderation for you.
But that's a very risky idea, because what that means, if you want to say that the way to find the middle ground is whatever works for you, that's basically what you're saying, so then there's no system. How do you know when you're there? Like, what if what works for you is wrong? What if it's not in the middle ground? You're saying there's no objective middle. That's very difficult to say as well. By the way, Hilchos Tzedakah...
You said that you can't really do shuv until you're dead.
Pardon? You can't know that you're done. It's like an addiction. You know you've broken the addiction the day you die, right?
But at the same time,
right? But you want to be able to at least look. For example, if If you're an alcoholic, chas v'shalom, okay, and your extreme is that you drink way too much alcohol. So there's no doubt that Alcoholics Anonymous will say that the smart thing to do is go to the other extreme and never drink alcohol. I've had students at my table who are like adults, and I get struggled with alcoholism. They will not drink wine. If they've beaten it, they will not drink wine. They will only have grape juice. And they'll say to you, and the first time I encountered this, it was really surprising to me. I didn't know anything about this. Now I'm very careful to have grape juice on the table when people come over. But you know, that's an extreme. Like, you're sitting Friday night at Kiddush, and I realized it's not that he's afraid that if he has one sip of wine he's going to become an alcoholic again. It's that he's decided that for him, he's better off in that extreme. But that is an extreme. Right? So, can you get back to the middle ground? But he knows what the middle ground is. He's chosen not to be on it. Right? But there is a goal. There is a middle ground.
I don't necessarily agree with the statement that you should be in the middle ground for everything. Where in general, I don't think it's a good thing. I mean, because if everyone's on the middle ground for everything, then no one has any, like, individual personality.
I agree with you.
Oh, wait a second. Give me an example of a character trait.
Niceness. Yeah, kind of.
Okay, niceness. Yeah. Okay.
So if you join, if you're like right in the middle of the ground, and you know you're like you're not really like a nice person, you're not really like an angry person. Well, before you were just a very like extremely kind person. You therefore lose your personality. You lose that sense of kindness within you. And
what is it?
A healthy thing.
Well, what does it mean to be in the middle ground when it comes to niceness? Let's say. Let's think about this for a minute.
Right, well, so I kind of agree with Josh.
Let's say I'm having a discussion with you. Okay, you want to talk to me about something. So we're sitting down and we're talking. We're in the basement, right? And Mikey walks over and he says, listen, I just got to ask you a quick question. I turn around and say, will you shut up? Right? And I go back to you. So you look at me like, something off with that. That's just a horrible way to talk, right? Right? That would be an extreme, right? Now let's say I turn around and he says, sure. You know, he says, can I just ask something? I'm a nice guy. So I say, sure. So he starts asking me a question. Then he finishes and somebody else comes over. Mordechai comes over. He says, look, I just have to ask you a quick question. So I say, look, I don't want to be rude, whatever. So I ask, and the next thing you know, you're sitting there for 40 minutes, and I'm just answering everybody's questions, and I'm really being nice, and they're all happy because what a nice guy I am, right? But meanwhile, you're sitting there for 40 minutes, and you ask to talk to me, and you feel like an idiot. So that would be an extreme of niceness. So how do you find, there is a balance. How you define the balance is going to be a question, but there is a middle ground. There's a middle ground for everything, yeah?
That was Misha's point, though.
What was Misha's point?
No,
but in other words, that would be an example of where I think that people should be in the middle ground.
Well, it's,
you have to find the middle, and the question is going to be how we define the middle. But the first thing is it valid that everybody needs to find their middle ground? By the way, you can make a case for saying, and we're going to see whether this is true, whether in some character traits, middle grounds are subjective. That could be. I don't think so, by the way, but that could be. Because the measure of a character trait is in action, and actions are definable. So there is a middle ground. Whether that middle ground is an exact point that we're constantly trying to navigate ourselves towards one way or the other, or whether it's a barometer in the middle, which is a more range, you could make a case for both of those, but there is a middle ground. And by the way, if you start to notice this, you'll start to notice that the people we naturally gravitate to in life, for the most part, if we are in that middle area, if we're more or less moderate, are moderate people. And extreme people very often gravitate to extreme people. That's why you have a...
Traits requires a certain extreme. It's like to do be good, call them. And that's not a middle ground. That's an extreme.
That's a good example. Bikur cholim. Okay, visiting the sick. It's really a different measure of what Misha was talking about in kindness. But let's take that example. Let's say you think that it's a good thing, and it is, to mitzvah to visit the sick. Okay, so now let's say that it's Let's say it's you promised your son you're going to help him study for a chumash test, and then on your way home, you know, you see a car is broken down, and there's an elderly woman, and she's sitting there, and she looks like she doesn't know what to do, so you stop, and you help her. So I don't know if I'd call that an extreme, and if I got home an hour late for learning with my son, and I explained to him, I bet he didn't understand. But let's say that on my way home, I realized I haven't done chesed today yet. So I drive over to the hospital, and I spend the next 4 hours visiting all the sick people I can find in the hospital. And I do this every day. To the extent that I'm regularly getting home, my wife's asleep, my kids are asleep, I haven't spoken to them. And then I realize, like, there's so many lonely people in the hospitals on Shabbat. So I decide to visit the hospital. I end up not getting home for Shabbos. And the next thing I know, a month has gone by. I haven't spoken to my children. I haven't spoken to my wife. But I'm doing all this chesed. That's an extreme. That's not healthy. Well, so that gets back to our question. How do I define what the middle ground is? But I'm not there yet. I first want to know, do we agree that there is a middle ground? And that's healthy to find it. And you will find that if you put that question to the test, you'll see that there's always a middle ground and it's always healthy to find it.
But I think we can't really judge it if we find that the middle ground is always healthy unless we can define the middle ground first.
So that would be the challenge. That's what I said.
Correct.
Okay? So, okay, if you want to take this as a given and reserve the right to disagree, that's okay. But you will find that as you start to analyze these things, and by the way, it's not just about, like, why do you want to be in the middle ground, right? Like, why do I need to find the middle ground? So I don't find the middle ground, so I mess up my family relationship, but I'm doing all this incredible chesed. I don't know much about Martin Luther King's personal life, but it would be safe to say that he went to an extreme to some degree in terms of tolerance. Like, that was way beyond the call of duty, and he accomplished great things with it, right? How far an extreme do you go to in certain characters' ways? And what if, and did he pay a price, and was that price valid? It's an interesting question. Like, what if it broke up his marriage? It could have. What if it broke up his marriage? Does that mean the marriage wasn't meant to be? Does that mean... Pardon?
Did it?
No, it didn't, but that's not the point.
I mean,
well, we don't know what would have happened. One second, we don't know what would have happened. But, you know, I have absolutely no doubt that if he had a healthy relationship with his wife, there were times when he put the phone down, and there were times where he didn't work, and he spent time with his family. Because you cannot have a healthy relationship with your family if you don't spend time with them. So he found his moderation if he had a healthy relationship. But we could debate that, right? But just to finish this this halacha, right? So this is a very strange definition. You know, we have to stop here. So we'll get back to this, Bezrat Hashem. But this is a very strange definition which we're going to have to define. How can you define the middle ground as something which is just in between the two extremes? That seems such a vague way of looking at something, and it's so un-Maimonidean that we're going to have to understand it.